The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Liz Elliott from the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, June 2019, Volume 20, Number 6. This is the fourth of four installments of the June 2019 issue. On the front of this month's cover, through the magic of digital photography, we have three identical Oprahs. The first one has a yellow long-sleeved V-neck dress on, and it's just below the knees. She's holding the hem of the dress and flouncing it out as she walks forward. It's accessorized with orange pointed-toe high-heel shoes. The second and third pictures of Oprah have her in exactly the same pose and exactly the same dress, except the second Oprah has on an orange dress with coral shoes, and the third Oprah has on a coral dress with yellow shoes. All of this is pictured against a bright white background, and in the upper left-hand corner, there is a gradient square behind a big white O, the Oprah logo, that's almost a perfect circle with an oval opening in the center. And the gradient square has three colors on the inside to coordinate with Oprah's dresses. The left-hand side is yellow, and then it fades into a soft orange and eventually into a coral color. And the quote on the front of this month's cover is, "Let every step you take move you forward." We'll start off this month by heading to the Let's Eat section. And the top right-hand third of the page is taken up by a picture of a rectangular pizza on a wire cooling rack. And it has red sauce all in the center. And the edge of the rectangular pizza has a very crispy-looking crust with some brown bubbly cheese. And there's a tiny caption that says, "Pro tip, generously grease your pizza pan with softened, unsalted butter instead of oil. The milk solids will encourage a deeper browning of the crust." And the article is entitled, "Love at First Slice." This puffy pie from Emily and Matt Hyland, authors of Emily, the Cookbook, has a cheesy surprise and a sweet backstory. We both have many distinct memories that involve pizza, including the first time we hung out when we ordered in and ate a pepperoni and olive pie out of the box on Matt's dorm room floor. Over the years, eating pizza together became our favorite pastime. And when we lived in Manhattan's Battery Park City, the first year we were married, we fell in love with the chewy, square, grandma-style slices at our neighborhood spots. Matt started baking similar pies at home, and when we were planning the menu at our New York City restaurant, Emmy Squared, we came to find out we were actually making what's known as a Detroit-style pizza. This pie has a lightly puffed crust, lots of cheese and sauce on top, and, unlike the traditional grandma, extra cheese sprinkled along the perimeter of the pan, creating a delightfully crispy-edged crust. We hope this edible tribute to our newlywed days will be as memorable to our guests as the story is to us. And the recipe that follows is called the Grammy. It makes six slices, and the total time is 2 hours plus 1.5 to 2 days for chilling and proofing the dough. At least 45 minutes before baking, place a baking sheet or a pizza stone in the top third of the oven and preheat to 525 degrees. Uncover chilled Detroit pie dough, and you can find that recipe at oprahmag.com. Mix together half cup, or about 2 ounces each, shredded mild cheddar and low moisture mozzarella. Around edges of pan, sprinkle heavily about 2/3 of cheese and evenly scatter remainder in the center of the dough. Using 6 tablespoons of store-bought marinara or red sauce, which you can find a recipe for at oprahmag.com, spoon 2 strips about 1.5 inches wide and 1 inch apart over the dough, leaving a 1-inch border on all sides. Sprinkle with 2 tablespoons grated Pecorino Romano. In oven, place pan onto heated sheet or stone and bake until top is evenly golden brown and edges are crisp, about 10 minutes. Remove from oven and let stand about 1 minute. Using a small knife, loosen pizza on all sides. Using a spatula, transfer to a cutting board or serving platter. With a pizza wheel, cut into 6 slices and serve immediately. And again, for the Highlands Detroit pie dough and red sauce recipes, simply visit oprahmag.com. Now we'll head to the reading room for 3 reviews, the first being Dog Days. In Mary Miller's waggish new novel, a crotchety antihero makes a furry friend. Poor Louis McDonald. On the cusp of his 64th birthday, he's newly divorced, fat, and grease-stained, chugging white Russians and waiting on an inheritance as elusive as a mirage. He's snarky with strangers and a confirmed chauvinist. He's even alienated his grown daughter. As the everyman protagonist of Biloxi, Mary Miller's vibrant novel set in coastal Mississippi, he gorges on IHOP and Domino's, dreaming of romance but convinced he hasn't got a shot in hell. Salvation is close at hand, though, in the guise of a floppy-eared collie named Layla, after the Eric Clapton song. Lewis takes custody of the pup during a couple's bizarre breakup. When Layla's owner, Sasha, one half of the pair who split, unexpectedly moves in with them, he envisions a future with a new lady and the sweet-tempered canine he shampoos with Head and Shoulders. But with each step forward, Lewis falls further behind, a victim of grifts and betrayals, seeking love to soothe his psychic wounds. Layla turns out to be more constant than Sasha. Lewis feels purpose in their strolls along the boardwalk and peanut butter-filled heart-to-hearts, proving the adage about man's best friend. Miller spins her story in sentences as salty as sea air. Here, Lewis mulls on how to appear normal on a date. I hoped I was doing a decent job of maintaining eye contact, not too little and not too much. I wasn't sure what was too little and what was too much. Southern writers must reckon with the legacies of Welty and O'Connor, but there's more than a little anti-Tyler pixie dust scattered over Biloxi, too, with its quirky misanthropes whose outward rough edges mask their tender insides. Miller paints a simple yet luminous portrait, revealing how even the crankiest among us can learn a few new tricks when it comes to human connection. Our next review is entitled La Familia. A first-time novelist draws on her ancestry for a sweeping saga. Epic in scale and richly detailed, The 7 or 8 Deaths of Stella Fortuna by Juliet Grahams spins a tale of mothers and daughters across 100 years and 2 continents. Grahams's debut unearths deep buried secrets of an Italian-American family. Enigmas that retain their mystery even when brought into the light. Maria Stella Fortuna, the precocious title character, became infamous before age 10 for her superpower-like ability to elude the Grim Reaper. As a fetching, barefoot child in a poor Calabrian village, Stella was almost killed by burning oil, barely survived evisceration by pigs, and emerged from a coma after being struck on the head. Several other close calls came before she emigrates with her family to America in 1939 at 19, on the orders of her brutish capo father. But even a world away from her native land, Stella can't escape its reach. Forced to marry, she becomes an unwilling wife and furious matriarch, the mother of 10 and grandmother of the narrator, who writes, "My life is only one of the many she spared by not ending her own." Grames holds the reader under his spell from start to finish as she constructs a puzzle of identity formed against convention. She herself is the daughter of an Italian immigrant, she reveals in her author's note. Though fiction, she creates the plausible contours of a past that might have resembled the one her grandmother concealed. Grames's clear and compassionate voice lets the figures of her heritage move freely, telling stories that inhibition kept them from sharing in life, and ultimately asserting the truth of a woman who was strong enough to defeat death, but not tradition. Our final review is entitled No Reservations. It was at age 8 that Ruth Reichel became obsessed with food, she recalls in her sublime new memoir, Save Me the Plums. Her father was a graphic designer who loved prowling used bookstores while his daughter tagged along, amusing herself by reading old copies of Gourmet. Those hours among the stacks nurtured Reichel's culinary passion and paved the way for her to become, decades later, editor-in-chief of that very magazine. And while Reichel's latest book is a foodie's delight, it's at its most delectable when recalling, with wistfulness, the community she left behind in 2009 when Gourmet was shuttered after 10 years under her stewardship. What lifted her from her sadness? She pulled out a recipe for Lucio's apple pancakes that she and her parents had loved, and took eggs and milk from the refrigerator and flour from the cupboard. Her son danced as the scent of butter filled the room. When she was done, Reichel slid that floppy crepe out of the skillet, sprinkled it with sugar, rolled it up, heated rum, and struck a match. And then they ate. That wraps all the reviews up in the reading room. Now we'll move to the feeling good section and our final feature articles. And we'll start with an article entitled Liquid Asset. Hurricane Harvey took almost everything Sarah Kress owned. But O Life Coach Martha Beck is helping her realize what it also gave her. It's been nearly 2 years since Houston resident Sarah Kress watched helplessly as most of her possessions were destroyed in the floods of Hurricane Harvey. The disaster left the now 41-year-old writer anxious, depressed, and devoid of creative energy, so she called life coach Martha Beck in search of relief. Martha, who confirmed that her client was experiencing symptoms of PTSD, encouraged Sarah to tell her story as a first step toward healing. She also advised self-compassion and patience, since trauma provokes a transformation as profound as a literal metamorphosis. Do you know what caterpillars do in a cocoon? They don't just grow wings, they dissolve. Though Sarah is currently suspended in that liquefied state, Martha is confident that she'll eventually be able to fly. To check on her progress, let's drop in on their final session. It begins with Martha Beck asking, "Sarah, how have you been?" Sarah responds, "I'm feeling better. In our last session, when you and I just talked about accepting things that are different after the hurricane, it was really freeing. It's been easier to let myself cry when I feel like instead of just pushing down the emotion." Martha: "Fantastic." Sarah: "I still dream about the flood a lot. Usually the dreams aren't about water itself. They're about the aftermath and being in this weird place where I don't know what'll happen next." Martha: "It might be useful for us to talk about that. Dreams reveal so much about what's happening in our subconscious. Is there one that's particularly vivid for you?" Sarah. Recently, I dreamed that my husband and I were living in a temporary apartment because we'd been flooded. I realized a window was open and I got up to close it, but then a man came lumbering through. I was paralyzed. He started to attack me, but my husband pulled him off and jumped on him. I ran outside for help and saw a family who told me they get someone. I was afraid to go back into the apartment, but when I did, my friends were there and the guy was dead. My husband came out of the bathroom completely unruffled and told me everything was fine. Martha. Fascinating. The psychiatrist Carl Jung believed that every single thing in a dream symbolizes an aspect of yourself. My method of dream interpretation is based on his work. It's challenging because you have to pretend you're different symbols in the dream, which may feel foolish at first, but since you're a poet, I think you'll get the hang of it quickly. Do you want to try? Sarah. Sure. Martha. So first of all, I want you to imagine you're the flood. I know it's not even in the dream, but sink into the feeling of that terrible thing and say, I am the flood. And then start to describe yourself. Sarah. Okay. I am the flood. I'm unknowable, catastrophic, and eventually I'm going to kill you. Martha. Oh, you're good at this. Okay, catastrophic flood. Why do you exist? Just throw anything out there that comes to mind. Sarah. I exist because no one has been paying attention to me. Martha. Very interesting. And what is your message for Sarah? Sarah. Life is suffering. Martha. All right. Now I want you to be the apartment. Describe yourself. Sarah. I'm empty. I have no personality. I have no art. Martha. Why do you exist? Sarah. To shelter. Martha. And what's your message for Sarah? Sarah. You will always end up back here. Martha. What about the window? Describe yourself as the window. Sarah. I'm insecure. I'm going to fail you. Martha. Why do you exist? Sarah. For people to come in and out. Martha. What's your message for Sarah? Sarah. Make sure I'm always closed. Martha. Okay, I have another question for you, Window. How are you going to help her? Sarah. I'm her path to safety. Martha. Now, describe yourself as the robber. Sarah. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have the right tools, and I'm highly disorganized. Martha, what's your purpose here? Sarah, I want to destroy something, but I'm not sure what. I'm chaos. Martha, okay, let's go through what you just described. A catastrophic thing has happened to you, and its message for you is that life is suffering. And now you're in a place where everything's been stripped away. You're stranded in a part of your psyche that's empty. You've given up art. You've given up feeling. You're seeking shelter here, but it's depressing and empty. You feel like a snail inside its shell, right? Sarah, yes. Martha, the window is intriguing. Though your instinct is to keep it closed, you also believe it's a path to safety. In our sessions, you're opening a window into your feelings, which is scary because that's how chaos gets in. When the robber comes through that window, you want to jump on this guy and kill him. A big part of you is paralyzed, but there's another powerful part that fights back. The fighter may look like your husband in the dream, but he's actually the part of you that knows exactly how to save yourself. The vulnerable part of you wants to run outside for help, and you meet a big family who's right there for you. That's you reaching out to other people by talking to me, and eventually, I hope, joining a trauma recovery group where you'll find compassionate witnesses to what you've been through. Now, when you go back into your apartment, the chaos is dead, and you are absolutely A-okay. How is this interpretation landing for you, Sarah? It makes total sense. I'm stunned by how much information is there. Martha, when I asked you to be the flood and tell me why you exist, you said, because no one has been paying attention to me. That sounds like you were already suffering when the flood broke into your world and the horrific experience forced you into a reckoning. Sarah, you're right. I started therapy years ago, long before the hurricane, and my therapist kept saying things like, I know Harvey was very traumatic, but even before that, you were in a bad place. And it's true. I already had tendencies to obsess about things and cope with anxiety in unhealthy ways, like turning to food and alcohol. I'm starting to see that what I've been going through is about more than Harvey. Martha, sometimes a catastrophic event can break down the doors of your psyche. You may end up looking back and saying, Harvey set me free. Sarah, it did force me into making some big decisions. When it happened, I was working as a social media manager, and the job was so stressful that I was losing my hair. Once I added PTSD into the mix, coping was so much harder, and I finally realized it was time to quit. I'm a freelance writer now, which is something I'd wanted to do for years, but I was afraid. I'm not a huge success yet, but I'm doing okay. Martha, you can apply the idea of Jungian symbols not just to dreams, but to things that happen in real life, because that's how we make meaning. We turn things into symbols. Could you imagine yourself as Harvey and describe yourself to me? Sarah, sure. I am Harvey. I'm going to cause a lot of pain for a lot of people. I am inevitable. Martha, and why do you exist? Sarah, because generations of people haven't cared enough about the environment. Martha, and what are you here to tell Sarah? Sarah, I'm trying to help her think about the larger world instead of dwelling on the small things she tends to obsess over. Martha, when things happen, the meaning we give them is very personal and individual. You could make Harvey mean that life's a bitch and then you die, or you could make it mean that it's time to pay attention to your inner ecosystem. Are you nurturing your feelings? Are you being kind to yourself? Because if you don't tend to your inner life, eventually the stuff you've pushed back will come and flood you. What stirred inside you this session? Sarah, it felt like things were clicking into place in a way that my brain found very satisfying. Martha, as you continue to allow your emotions to surface and figure out the role the trauma played in your life, you'll continue to feel those clicks. It's almost like finding the solution to a math problem. I have a wacky suggestion. Maybe you should write a short story called My Friend Harvey, about all the things Harvey ended up doing for you. Sarah, that's probably a good way to get going again as a writer. Martha, writing is another way to make meaning out of the things that happen to you and to help other people who are living through chaos of their own. That's very powerful. Sarah, going through this with you has been very powerful. Martha, I feel the same way. expect things to get much, much better for you in the months to come. Sarah, thank you for everything. Martha, thank you. I'm looking forward to reading the great work you're going to create. Our next article is entitled, Can We Talk? This meetup group blends community, camaraderie, and crucial conversations. One Sunday a month, the Harlem Coffee Company in Upper Manhattan is suddenly more than a spot to down an iced latte. It becomes the site of intimate confessions, provocative debates, and discussions about race and sexuality. That's when WOKE, which stands for Women of Color Empowered, convenes. This New York City meetup group gives non-white women a forum to tackle essential topics. Amy Afua Smith, WOKE's founder, is the daughter of Ghanaian immigrants. During her training to become a clinical social worker, she noticed a troubling pattern. The concerns unique to women of color were often left out of our discussions, she says. At a presentation in 2017 about happiness, I asked the speaker, how do race, sexism, and sexual orientation affect overall happiness? And he said, I didn't research that. On a personal level, I knew that women of color, especially in the immigrant community, don't typically speak about mental health openly. So Smith started WOKE, which now has more than 880 members, ranging in age from early 20s to 60s, most through word of mouth. She found inspiration close to home. Every Sunday after church when I was growing up, my mom and her friends would meet up and talk about everything, work, men, family, says Smith. As I got older, I realized that this was their group therapy, a non-traditional way of tending to their mental health. I figured WOKE could serve the same purpose. Smith doesn't intend for WOKE to substitute for traditional therapy. She says some members, including her, do see professionals. Turning 40 drove me to it, she jokes. But she knows that's not an option for everyone. Women of color don't always have access to a therapist, let alone one who looks like them, she says. Plus, black women are often the breadwinner of their family. Spending an hour with someone every week, or even every 2 weeks, that commitment sometimes isn't feasible. Also, it's not always easy to face your stuff. If you've ignored your own issues and concerns for years, it can be overwhelming to go and unpack all of that with a stranger. Since its inception in February 2018, the group has explored everything from interracial relationships to the Me Too movement to prison reform. The January conversation examining the TV series Surviving R. Kelly was the most popular meeting to date. One of our bigger turnouts was for a talk centered around a woman of color's inability to be vulnerable because of societal expectations, says Smith. We're groomed to be strong and resilient. Some people said they'd never seen their mother cry until a funeral, or ever. Smith has been amazed by the need for this group. After each one, she says, people tell me things like, this is going to empower me for the rest of the week. Or I get messages saying, this month's topic is too difficult for me to discuss, but here's my story in case you want to share it anonymously. I try to break up all the seriousness with a trip to a museum or a dinner, she says. But honestly, even those end up being intense. It's like, let's have fun. And also, did you read this news story? Still, WOKE may be the only venue where some of these women feel free to talk about what's on their mind. And I'm happy to give them that space. Our next article is entitled, Beyond Belief. You've got the conviction. Now Linda Sarsour, co-chair of the Women's March on Washington, explains 7 ways to make your passion contagious. The first is, start small. I'm a very talkative Brooklynite. So when I sit next to someone on a flight, I'll say hi and ask a little about their life. Nothing political at all. I'm Muslim and wear a hijab, so sometimes people are sort of shocked that I'm talking to them. But even if it's a brief conversation, you never know what 5 minutes can do. If it can create a ripple effect, them going back to their family and saying, I met a Muslim woman on the plane and she said some things I agree with. I want to do more reading. Then it's worth it for me. The second is appeal to people's humanity. Instead of going over talking points, I tell real stories. I've met people who had to raise money for their child's surgery because they didn't have quality health care. So I might use that example and ask, don't you think it's unfair that Americans don't have access to health care in the same way Canadians or those in the UK do? And immediately people will say, yeah, that's not right. I believe wholeheartedly that every American loves their children and wants them to be safe and happy and have access to basic human rights. I start at that fundamental level. The third, be patient. We activists want people to hear our arguments and abandon homophobia, Islamophobia, and xenophobia right away, but that's not how the world works. It requires time to unlearn what's been embedded in our families for probably the last 100 years. Recognize that it's not a speedy process. The fourth is step up for those who can't. The burden shouldn't always be on people who are most directly impacted to make arguments for their own humanity. It may be difficult and demoralizing for, say, an undocumented immigrant to have to explain that they deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. But others can take on that role and try to ignite compassion. The next is dig deeper. Someone's perspective may seem absolutely unacceptable and outrageous, but I always ask, what happened that made you believe that? People learn something in childhood or have bad experiences that affect their perspective, and we should ask questions to get to the core of that issue. Ultimately, we need to ask why. Her next tip, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. I always ask people who want to become more politically engaged, are you ready to get disinvited from Thanksgiving dinner? Are you ready for tense moments at your family reunion? Because it requires that type of risk. You may have to say, no, it's not okay for you to support taking women's rights away. You have to have the courage to have tough conversations. Go to rallies, meet the organizers, be with other activists. But the real work you do is in your home, your church, your temple, your mosque, your supermarket, and your community center. And finally, stay hopeful. There was a guy trolling me on Twitter. Every time I posted something, he'd respond with really vitriolic anti-Muslim comments or call me a libtard, and I never blocked him. In 2017, two other women and I got into a debate with him, and the conversation actually turned productive. Over months, he changed his views. He's now come to my defense online many times. Call me naive, but I believe in everyone's potential to change, evolve, and be moved. Ultimately, my responsibility is to try. Regardless of whether the person learns or doesn't want to, I've done my job. Now, our final article is called Lost and Found, Sifting Through the Rubble of Pain and Doubt. Lee Woodruff discovers unexpected treasure. My life imploded with a phone call. While reporting from Iraq, my husband had been hit by a roadside bomb. Critically wounded, shrapnel to the brain, might not make it through surgery. I could barely absorb the meaning of the words. He was transferred to the military hospital in Lenstal, Germany. When I got there, his room was meat locker cold to minimize swelling. Bob lay naked on a bed, partially covered by a sheet. His body, white as marble, still as a sculpture. For a moment, I let myself believe he was asleep. But his head was pockmarked with shrapnel wounds, a ragged trail of staples closing his scalp over a horribly distorted brain. 72 hours later, he was flown to Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he'd be comatose for 5 weeks, eyes open without seeing, moaning without speaking. My world shrank down to caring for our 4 children, all of them under the age of 14, and waiting for their father to wake up. One day, out of the blue, he did. Bob couldn't recall who was the president of the United States, but he could say Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. We were elated that he could talk at all. At a rehab hospital in New York, he began the grueling work of relearning how to string sentences together, read and write. That's where my euphoria started to fade. I sat across from him as the therapist held up a plastic head of lettuce. "What's this called?" she chirped. "Salad?" Bob's eyes darted toward me apologetically. I smiled, trying not to mouth the right answer. After college, I'd fallen in love with his inquisitive mind, the fact he could speak Mandarin and easily explain things like the Six-Day War. Bob was here. And not. A month and a half later, thin and tired, he walked through our front door. The twins ran in to hug him, waving welcome home signs made with crayons and glitter. We were a family again, snuggling on the couch, watching hours of TV as the children touched the places on his face where the shards of shrapnel were still working their way out. With the fear of Bob dying in full remission, tricky emotions filled the void. Just weeks before the explosion, he'd taken over for Peter Jennings as co-anchor of the ABC World News Tonight. His recovery would be lengthy, the outcome uncertain. How would he cope with the death of that dream? And what of the hard work we'd both invested in his career, constantly pulling up stakes and moving to yet another city as he made his way up the ladder? If he could no longer work, how would we raise 4 kids on my freelance copywriter income? I felt like a shrew even thinking about money. In his early recovery, everyday moments felt like a series of paper cuts. The joke he didn't get, the conversation that ricocheted around the dinner table too fast for him to follow, the meeting with our lawyer, who'd advised I'd take control of our assets until things stabilized. "I don't understand," Bob said, looking up from a pile of papers as the lawyer awaited his signature. "Why is everything in my wife's name?" His confusion was a gut punch. For months, I'd been pumping out good vibes like a cheerleader, staying upbeat for the kids, arranging my supportive wife facade for everyone else. "Your husband looks so good." Cue the polite smile. "You're so lucky," beamed the grateful look. But the fact is, loss that falls short of death is complicated. A therapist told me about ambiguous loss, something experienced by a quiet club that grieves in the shadows. Women who've miscarried, parents of disabled children or addicted children, people with a chronically ill spouse. The death of 1,000 dreams. There are no rituals for that kind of grief. No poems or tributes. No mourning, no resolution. Life plays out in a purgatory of what-ifs. "I actually envy you," I confided to my widowed friend one day, radical honesty being our bond. "You have nowhere to go but up. What if Bob never really comes back?" It's been 13 years, and after a miraculous recovery, Bob is back. He's reporting, speaking Mandarin, traveling to all the remote places that fascinate him. And he's heroically peaceful about what wasn't. "How do you know I wouldn't have failed as the anchor?" he jokes. Sense of humor restored. I sometimes wonder whether I've been looking at this all wrong. Maybe, instead of ambiguous loss, the trick is to be open to ambiguous gain. Like when Bob went to our kids' back-to-school night for the first time in several years, something he'd never been able to do as an anchor. "So this is what I've been missing," he said, sitting in a third grader's cramped desk, reading a note our daughter had left for us. Or the way he started packing lunches, making the ham and cheese sandwiches and slicing apples. Our catastrophe allowed us to raise millions of dollars for injured veterans. And it allowed me to write, not just press kits for kitty litter and plantar wart cream, but essays and books from my heart. When Bob was in a coma, a friend gave me a string of lapis worry beads. I'd clutch them when I couldn't sleep, putting a name to my many worries until I could finally drift off. At a certain point, I renamed them gratitude beads. Now when I'm stressed, I touch each one and name something I'm grateful for. My children's good health, a coven of incredible girlfriends, my able body to hike and garden, my intact husband. And it works. Nothing ambiguous about it at all. Next, we're going to look back at an article from March of 2017 called The Halfway House. They married, struggled, divorced, struggled some more. Then they became neighbors, and I learned what all that turmoil had earned them. Until recently, I lived on the top floor of a Harlem brownstone. My ex-husband lived on the bottom floor, and the neighbors between us were lawyers, not ours. We no longer shared a last name, but we did share our 3-year-old son and a mailman who left a rubber-banded stack in the lobby each day. I'd flip through my ex's Amazon deliveries to find my student loan statements. I didn't know if we'd ever get back together, but I did know he was eligible for a 0% interest credit card. When we married in 2012, we knew the risk of putting on wedding rings was that we one day might take them off. When that risk became our reality, we were determined, for our son's sake, to divorce differently. He refused to be a weekend-only father. I refused to be an ex-wife who communicated solely via voicemails or voodoo dolls. For 2 years, we shuffled our boy back and forth. We went to therapy separately and together, and saw our marriage for what it was, mostly a failure. I was starting a graduate program and needed a place near campus. We agreed that any extra minutes in my schedule should be spent with our son rather than on a subway. While apartment hunting, we stumbled on a building with both a top and bottom floor for rent. The price was right, the light was good, and we were feeling optimistic. We signed 1-year leases and thought, how bad could it be? On move-in day, we sat on our stoop and tried to define a structure. We exchanged keys, but promised not to peek. We agreed that romantic partners would not be invited over. Instead, we could get a hotel room, his suggestion, or remain celibate, mine. We knew boundaries would be blurry, but vowed to keep a healthy distance. It turned out that any distance, healthy or otherwise, was impossible. He heard when I came and went, my heels heavy on the 45 steps between us. On nights I made dinner, he would call upstairs to say, "Smells good," and I'd bring down leftovers. Every night, when he headed home from work, he'd text, "On my way, need anything?" I'd respond, "No, thanks." It took living together again to make me less dependent on him. It took us not being married for him to become more considerate of me. Sometimes, I'd watch him leave in a suit, knowing he'd dressed for someone else. Sometimes, the housekeeper mixed our laundry because she wanted to save water and sneaked one of his shirts into my stack because she wanted to save our relationship. If I was feeling nostalgic or lonely or both, I'd put it on, inhaling the lavender detergent a trace of his cologne, and the sweet odor of our son's sweat. This is what our divorce smelled like. It was, to me, proof of a family intact. There's a moment after a breakup when you're supposed to say goodbye and go in opposite directions. To do so, someone has to turn and start walking away. Neither of us did. We still wanted to bear witness to the other's life, long after we'd asked a judge to grant us the freedom not to. Our friends and family were confused and amused, wondering how it would end. I told them living together let me pursue my education and still be the mother I wanted to be. I didn't tell them that being my ex's neighbor made me miss being his wife. I told them that our living situation forced us to be kind and careful. I didn't tell them that this kindness and care erased much of the damage we'd done. I told them that, of course, it was messy and confusing. I didn't tell them that I would rather have a complicated life near him than a simpler one without him. When our leases were up, we let them go and searched for a new home together, a place where we could become the partners we were finally ready to be. Now we're going to move to the refresh section of the June 2019 issue. And the caption at the top of the page says, "Free your mind." And rest will follow with the help from these comforting finds. And there's pictures of six items on the page. The first one is a set of cards with all kinds of beautiful colors and patterns. And the card on the top of the pile reads, "Calm. Cards for Serenity." And the caption reads, "Temper fugit. Prepare to feel as chill as Enya sounds." Each note in this 60-card pack is printed with a big picture musing, like, "Take a short break from the exhausting business of thinking about yourself to help extinguish small-time annoyances." Calm prompt cards, $15. You can find those at theschooloflife.com. The second picture is of a brass bowl and a wooden mallet. And the caption reads, "Close harmony." Nope, this isn't a potpourri dish. It's a made-in-Nepal brass singing bowl. When struck by a small wooden mallet, it produces rich tones, believed to decrease stress and increase meditative focus. Doesn't that sound good? The original Om bowl, $35. The omstore.co, and that is spelled the omstore.co. The third picture is of two pillows. One is a rectangle with a white background and an orange, purple, and coral icat pattern on it. And the pillow on top of that is a kidney-shaped coral pillow. And the caption for that reads, "Pillow talk. Practicing mindfulness with a sore keister just doesn't cut it. Double your comfort with this cushy set. One pad supports the spine and hips. The other gives knees and ankles a soft place to land. Half Moon Meditation Cushion and Zebuton Limited Edition, $160. ShopHalfMoon.com. The fourth picture is a glass urn with a marble pattern on the inside, white and black and gray, and it's sitting upon a black electrical device. And the caption reads, "In the air tonight. Diffuse worries with this dapper aromatherapy device. Fill the hand-blown vase with water and a few drops of your favorite essential oil, and pretty soon perfumed steam will waft through your home. Green Air Carrera Marble Ultrasonic Diffuser, $59.50 plus international shipping, indigo.com. The fifth picture is purple long incense stick. And the caption reads, "Burn notice. The simplest pick-me-up is only a matchstick away. When your abode's vibes, and maybe its aroma, feel iffy, light one of these smokeless incense sticks to introduce your personal domain to rosewood and jasmine-scented peace. Bata Ritual Incense and Purify, $28, abchome.com. And the sixth picture is a tablet that is mounted upon a flat black easel. And its caption reads, Disappearing Act. Can a zenned out version of Etch-a-Sketch bring you closer to bliss? Maybe. Dip a paintbrush in water, draw on this canvas, and watch your design evaporate, leaving behind a sense of harmony and a clean slate. Original Buddha Board, $35, Amazon.com. Now we'll move to the Love That section of the June 2019 Oprah, and this one is all about swimming and bathing suits, and the opening page has a rainbow, vertically striped background, and half of the page is taken up by a lady in a one-piece horizontally rainbow striped bathing suit with a blue cover up, and she's got bright red nails and two bangle bracelets, and her hair is blowing in the breeze. And the caption beside it says, O's Summer Style Handbook. Sun's out, surf's up, and swim season is about to begin. You'll be ready for the good times with creative director Adam Glassman's flattering and fun pics. And right beside the bathing suit, the caption reads, Full Spectrum. Get a big dose of sunny summer optimism in one rainbow-hued suit. Happy vibes guaranteed. One piece, Michael Kors from the Rainbow Capsule Collection and Celebration of Pride, $104. And the cover-up is an anorak listed for $195. They both can be found at michaelkors.com. And that's all of the fashion we're going to look at today, so we have time to wrap up with what I know for sure. Oh, what a time to be a woman. We are standing up for what we believe and taking a stand on behalf of others. Reminds me of one of my favorite songs and personal happy dance anthem, Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves. Just take a look at the 42 new female members of Congress and the firepower they're bringing to this country's discourse. And Nancy Pelosi modeling what 79 and powerful can be. Look at Force of Nature, Stacey Abrams, the best-selling memoirist of all time, Michelle Obama, who's created a movement of women becoming. Marie Kondo is sparking new ways to think about home. Lori Lightfoot is the first African-American and openly gay person to be elected mayor of Chicago. Everywhere you turn, from the arts to commerce, from politics to sports, women are doing what we do best, showing up. We're there for our aging parents, our divorcing friends, our scared and sometimes scary teenagers. We listen. Knowing that sometimes folks don't need answers, they just need to be heard. Maybe nurturing is just hardwired into our psyche. Or maybe we simply prefer progress to impediment, comfort to carnage. Whatever the reason, women are protectors of life, not masters of war. Nowhere was this more evident than in the response to the mosque massacres in Christchurch, New Zealand. In the wake of the killings, Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern became a peace master. She demonstrated empathy in motion. She showed us what it means to have the courage of your convictions, and she set a global standard for leadership. Addressing the scourge of extremism and racism plaguing our world today, she said, We each hold the power, in our words and in our actions, in our daily acts of kindness. The answer lies in our humanity. Women across her country showed their solidarity by wearing headscarves to emulate the hijab Miss Arndern chose to mourn in, and the Muslim community felt that recognition and respect. 50 murders that could have caused even more destruction instead led to an image of the Prime Minister displayed across Dubai's tallest building, with the word peace shining above it in Arabic and English alike. Jacinta Ardern projected goodness, and the Arab world projected it right back for all to take in. Suddenly, the other didn't seem so different from us. I had always, from afar, admired Miss Arden's chutzpah and authenticity, but this, I know for sure, was the pinnacle of leadership. I'm grateful the world has her as a role model. We all need to channel our inner Jacinda and become daily masters of peace, empathy, and compassion. We have to make the choice every single day to exemplify the truth, the respect, and the grace that we wish for in this world. Tell it, write it, sing it, proclaim it, be it. There's never been a better time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, reading for Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.